Hare
All his disciples were around his feet. They were chanting, and I tried to chant along and learn the mantra too. I had heard the chanting of Hare Krishna once before at a peace march, and I had found it very beautiful. Then the Swami spoke. I had the impression that this person was not earthly, and I thought, here is the person I'm looking for. He seemed to be different from everyone else, like he came from some other place or universe. I was attracted. After a second kirtan, the Swami and his followers rolled up their rug, picked up their instruments, and began to leave. Bob walked back to the swings on the other side of the park to find his wife and child, but the image of the Swami stayed with him. He seemed different from everyone else. His accent had been thick. Yet Bob resolved to go to the storefront in a few days to hear him speak. Here is a leader, thought Bob. Dan and his wife sauntered off into the park, sampling the various groups of musicians. His wife was surprised that Dan, who was usually shy, had danced at the kirtan. He said he might go over to the storefront one day and hear the Swami speak. Judy just stood there hallucinating. She held a Stay High Forever pamphlet in her hand and read it over and over and over. While she was thinking the whole event must have come from another planet, a man walked up and asked, "Would you like to go where the Swami is?" She nodded. At the storefront, one of the devotees offered Judy some prasadam, a chapati, and then invited her up to the Swami's room. Upstairs, she entered the large front room, which was filled with fragrant smoke. There were tall flower vases, and sesame seeds were on the floor. She saw the Swami bow before the little picture of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, and then stand and leave the room, closing the door behind him. Judy decided that he must have been bowing to the floor itself. Around her, everyone was softly chanting on beads, and although she couldn't make out the words, it seemed peaceful. One of the Swami's disciples told her she should come into the back room, and she followed, curious. The Swami was sitting there on his mat, looking effulgent. There were about 10 other people in the room. Prabhupada asked her if she liked the chanting in the park, and she replied, "I loved it." "Do you live near here?" he asked. Judy flashed on the idea that she was the all-pervading truth, and answered in a way which she thought must have sounded very mystical. "Oh, I live very near." "Good," said Swami. "Then you can come for our morning kirtan and classes." Then she realized that she didn't live so near, and it would mean traveling an hour and a half from the Bronx to visit the Swami. But she decided that since he had asked her, she would come. Then she thought, I am making this up. But Prabhupada assured her, as if knowing her thoughts, "This process is nothing you have made up. It is very old, very simple, and sublime." He leaned back. "We are eternal," he said, and everything around us is temporary. Judy was now coming down from the LSD. By the time she left the Swami, it was late. She had wanted to stay overnight, but the boys hadn't allowed her. But she was determined to join. For Bob, it seemed natural to follow up on what he had seen in the park. He began attending the evening classes, and he started reading the Bhagavatam at home and chanting. He framed the picture from the Bhagavatam dust jacket depicting the spiritual sky and placed it on his small homemade altar. He would offer flowers before the picture and sit before it, chanting Hare Krishna. Bob was fascinated by the philosophy and the books and classes, and from the very beginning he was amazed that Swamiji's teachings answered all his questions. He listened carefully and accepted. It seemed like once I decided that he was telling the truth, I just accepted everything he said. Not that part of it was the truth and the rest of it I would have to think about. October 19th. It was Monday evening after the Sunday kirtan in the park. Dan arrived at the storefront for kirtan. The kirtan was in full swing. And when he entered, the first thing he noticed was some people playing on the innards of an upright piano leaning against the wall near the door. A boy handed him some wooden sticks, and he sat down and joined in the kirtan. Then came the Swami's lecture, which Dan thought was long and serious, about how sexual desire causes bondage and suffering. The temple was crowded and stuffy, and Dan was shocked by the lecture. But he stayed on because he knew there would be another kirtan. He felt uneasy that the Swami's followers were all celibate, but because he liked the kirtans, he resolved to keep coming. The Swami wasn't quite what Dan had expected. He had imagined something of a light-hearted Zen Roshi, laughing and joking, with sparkling eyes and words filled with paradoxes. But he found the Swami just the opposite, very straightforward and even cutting in his speech, and his mouth turned down at the corners, making him look mournful. Dan happily took to the kirtans, thinking they would aid his impersonal meditation, but the lectures kept stressing that God was a person. Dan resisted. He mentally debated with Prabhupada. He was partial to Dr. Radhakrishnan's interpretation of the Gita, and yet the Swami often launched ruthless attacks against such impersonal ideas. Gradually, Dan saw his impersonal barrier crumble, and he came to admit that on every count, the Swami was right. Judy began attending both the morning and evening classes. She had to rise by 5 o'clock to get to the storefront on time, and her mother and father protested. But Judy didn't care. She would ride an hour and a half on the subway before dawn, downtown to the Swami's meetings, where she would be the only girl present. When the Swami heard that Judy was an art student, he asked her to paint for Krishna. She set up a canvas in the front room of the apartment, and under his guidance, she began painting. For her first assignment, he asked her to paint a portrait of his Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He gave her a photo and instructed her. There should be a flower garland around Guru Maharaj's neck. The tilak should be yellowish, not white. And there should be no effulgence or halo around his head. Bob. I began chanting and studying the Srimad Bhagavatam at home and attending the kirtan and classes at the storefront. After the last kirtan in the evening, the Swami would take a bowl made of simulated wood and a little paring knife and a couple of apples that had been sitting on the edge of his lectern, and he would cut the apples up into the little bowl and hand the bowl to a disciple. The disciple would then offer him the first piece and he would pop it into his mouth. The rest of the pieces of apple would be distributed to the crowd. I remember one time when he was chewing on his piece of apple, he spit the seeds out on the floor up against the wall. They bounced off the wall onto the floor next to the dais. And I was thinking, how wonderful. No one else can do that. No one else would have the nerve to do such a thing. With his aesthetics filmmaker's eye, Dan appreciated Swamiji's manner. Dan, there was a sink right next to the dais where he sat. It was so close that he could have leaned over and touched it. After cutting up an apple, he would take the scraps and just fling them into the sink. It was very casual. I was impressed by that. And one time Brahmananda came up and wanted 50 cents for something. And the Swami reached down and picked up his little black purse, the kind that closes by a metal clasp at the top. He snapped it open, looked inside very perspicaciously. That's a good one. And then his hand came up like a bird, like an eagle hovering in flight above its prey. But the hand didn't pounce. It just delicately drifted down, took out a 50-cent piece, and rose up again as if it were being lifted up on a balloon. It was graceful. It was a dance, a ballet. He just picked up this 50-cent piece and lifted it into Brahmananda's hand. I couldn't believe it. Someone asks you for a 50-cent piece. You just dig in your pockets and throw it at them. But the Swami seemed to treat everything as Krishna's property. And this 50-cent piece was treated with such care. The weeks went by. Some of the devotees had spoken to Bob about initiation, but he was unsure. He didn't know exactly what initiation was. But it seemed to him that the other devotees were eager to get him initiated because he was working and had a family. To Bob's way of thinking, he represented maturity to them, a middle-class American, and they were eager to land him. Bob's wife wasn't interested, and his friends were downright opposed. He couldn't spend much time with Prabhupada or the devotees, since he was either at the office or at home with his family. Bob. So they were asking me if I was interested in initiation. I said I would think about it. I hadn't stopped smoking. I hadn't made the final decision. The first real exchange I had with the Swami was when I asked for initiation. The rest of the time, I was so much in awe in him that it didn't occur to me to say anything. I always wanted to. I felt puffed up, and I always thought, well, I should be able to talk to him. Maybe I should do something. But I was always kind of reluctant to do it. I didn't think it was my place. I guess maybe I was afraid, but I was getting up early and chanting 32 rounds a day, many of them on the subway. I was afraid of the material world because I didn't have much association with devotees, and I wanted to insulate myself by chanting more. Judy was another person who was considering initiation, and I asked her what she was going to do about it, and she said, I'm thinking about it. And then she told me she had decided she would get initiated and give up all her bad habits. I began to think maybe I could give these I could give up these things too. So I asked what to do. How do I approach him? And Kirtanananda said, well, you go up to his room. I was surprised it was so easy. I had prepared a little speech in my mind. Quote, my dear Swamiji, would you kindly accept me as your disciple and teach me about Krishna consciousness? I went up to the room without an appointment and knocked on the door. I heard him say, come in. I entered the room and he was sitting behind his desk. He was alone. I made obeisances and he looked at me and said, yes. And I said, Swamiji, will you make me your disciple? And that's as far as I got. I was going to say, and teach me the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, but he didn't let me finish my speech. He said, yes. It was so simple. I thought, well, there's nothing else to say. He has accepted me. So I thanked him and paid my obeisances and left. You know you're not supposed to be up there unless you're initiated, Achyutananda said. Judy was flustered. She had come upstairs to put some dirty pots in the kitchen. Oh, yes, she replied. That's just what I wanted to talk to Swamiji about. And she went into Prabhupada's room, where he was talking with a few other people. "Swamiji, could I please get initiated?" she asked. And he said, "Do you know the four rules?" "Yes." "Can you follow them?" "Yes." "Then you can be initiated in 2 weeks." Dan was also thinking about initiation, but he wanted to wait. He was chanting 16 rounds and attending all the classes, despite his reluctant wife. He had always difficulty with authority figures, but he could feel that the Swami was winning him over and wearing down his impersonal barrier. 2 weeks later, Prabhupada held another initiation ceremony. Bob became Rupanuga. Judy became Jadarani. Dan needed a little more time. Yeah, Jadarani was the first girl. Because originally Prabhupada was thinking there wouldn't be any girls. But because she was so determined, then. Chapter 10. Wow, Rupanuga. So, yeah. I say. Introduction to the chapter. But we were shocked that he was going to leave. I never thought that Krishna consciousness would go beyond the Lower East Side. What to speak of New York City? I thought this was it, and it would stay here eternally. Brahmananda. Hare Krishna was becoming popular. Regular kirtans in the park, newspaper coverage. Hayagriva called it the Hare Krishna explosion. The Lower East Side hippies considered the chanting of Hare Krishna, quote, one of the grooviest things happening, end quote. And the Swami's disciples didn't take LSD, didn't seem to affect their popularity. The devotees were accepted as angelic people, carrying the peaceful chanting to others and offering free food and a free place to stay. You could get the most interesting vegetarian food free at their place if you went at the right time. And in the storefront, on the shelf by the door, were books from India. In the clubs, local musicians played the melody that they had picked up from the Swami when he chanted in the park and at the temple. The Lower East Side was a neighborhood of artists and musicians, and now was also the neighborhood of Hare Krishna. Burton Green. Musicians were influenced by it, the Krishna chant, Govinda Jaya Jaya, and other chants. I used some of these chants when I recorded. A lot of musicians reached out for this in different ways. We would explode in a short time and blow off, but then keep the chant underneath as a basis. A lot of people found that spiritual vibration even in the midst of this heavy music they were doing. They were becoming devotee musicians. Evening kirtans were always big. Brahmananda used to stand by the back door every night and watch the room fill up until there was no place left to sit. There was a lot of interest in the group chanting and music making. But after the kirtan, when the talk was to begin, people would start to leave. It was not uncommon for half the audience to leave before the talk began. And some people would leave in the middle of the lecture. One evening, Allen Ginsberg brought Ed Sanders and Tuli Kupferberg of the Fugs to the meeting. The Fugs, a local group that had made a name for themselves, specialized in obscene lyrics. Among the popular songs of Ed Sanders were Slum Goddess of the Lower East Side, Group Grope, and I Can't Get High. Ed had wild red hair and an electric red beard, and he played a guitar during the kirtan. The devotees were happy to see their prestigious guests. The night of the Fugs, however, Prabhupada chose to speak on the illusion of sexual pleasure. Sexual pleasure binds us to this material world, birth after birth, he said, And he quoted, as he often did, a verse of Yamunacharya. "Since I have become Krishna conscious, I never think of sex life with a woman. Whenever I think of sex life with a woman, my face at once turns from it and I spit at the thought." The fugs never returned. Yeah, Prabhupada, this is an example, is that, see, here's this news, hardly getting started, this and that. He's right in the middle of a scene where people, their main thing is, you know, how you say, illicit sex and drugs. Right? The vegetarian, most of them are into that and like that. And gambling, it's like, you know, you have to have money to do that. And these are all poor. So these two things were the basis of like their lifestyle and philosophy. But Prabhupada didn't do this, you know, idea of the so-called soft kind of preaching where you don't say anything, don't disturb anyone. He just immediately just says it. Right? So he's right in the middle of this scene, but they're accepted. Right? They, you know, it's known, wow, they're so nice, and they don't take drugs. Right? So they're accepted that they've already come to some nice level. So the whole point is, you know, you present it pleasantly for the audience that you have, but you don't not speak the philosophy. Right? You don't try to hide it, don't make excuses for it, feel bad about it. You know, think it's, you know, it's actually, you know, shouldn't be like this or that. No, this is just the way it is. And people need to hear that at some point. Right? So then Prabhupada would pick just what he knew would create some thought, right? Because if he just speaks along, that's okay. But you speak like this, people start to think. And then if they think, that's when they're going to properly take up Krishna consciousness. To speak ill of sexual pleasure was certainly not a strategic move for one who wanted to create followers among the Lower East Side hippies. But Prabhupada never considered changing his message. In fact, when Umapari had mentioned that Americans didn't like to hear that sex was only for conceiving children, Prabhupada had replied, "I cannot change the philosophy to please the Americans." "What about sex?" asked the ISKCON attorney, Steve Goldsmith, one evening speaking out from the rear of the crowded temple. "Sex should only be with one's wife," Prabhupada said, "and that is also restricted. Sex is for the propagation of Krishna-conscious children. My spiritual master used to say that to beget Krishna-conscious children, he was prepared to have sex 100 times. Of course, that is most difficult in this age. Therefore, he remained a brahmachari." "But sex is a very strong force," Mr. Goldsmith challenged. "What a man feels for a woman is undeniable. Therefore, in every culture, there is the institution of marriage," Prabhupada replied. "You can get yourself married and live peacefully with one woman. But the wife should not be used as a machine for sense gratification. Sex should be restricted to once a month and only for the propagation of children." Hayagriva, who was seated just to Swamiji's left, beside the large dangling symbol, spoke out suddenly, "Only once a month!" And with a touch of fastidious humor, he added loudly, "Better to forget the whole thing." "Yes, that's it. Very good boy," Swamiji laughed. And others joined him. "It is best not to think of it. Best just to chant Hare Krishna." And he held up his hands as if he were chanting on a strand of beads. "That way he will be saved from so much botheration. Sex is like the itching sensation, that's all. And as when we scratch, it gets worse. So we should tolerate the itching and ask Krishna to help us. It is not easy. Sex is the highest pleasure in the material world, and it is also the greatest bondage." But Steve Goldsmith was shaking his head. Prabhupada looked at him, smiling. "There is still a problem?" "It's just that, well, it's been proved dangerous to repress the sex drive. There's a theory that we have wars because people are eating meat," Prabhupada interrupted. "As long as people eat meat, there will be war. And if a man eats meat, he will be sure to have illicit sex also." Steve Goldsmith was an influential friend and supporter of ISKCON. But Prabhupada would not change the philosophy of Krishna consciousness to, quote, "please the Americans," end quote. We should always remember this one. You don't have to worry about pleasing the Americans. Yeah, so here's somebody who's influential, you know, he's a supporter of that, he wouldn't change. Umapati Maharaj also, he was speaking with us one day, and he made that point, is that at one point he had so many doubts in the philosophy and this and that, and he brought them to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada, you know, would not adjust for that. And so then, you know, the point was, is if he didn't adjust, Umapati would go away, but Prabhupada wouldn't adjust. You know, and at that time, there were, you know, you could see here, how many people are actually initiated, right? We had 11, and then 4, that's 15, right? 16, 17. So I don't know if it'll come up here, but basically speaking is that, you know, even though it would be, you know, such a major portion of the ISKCON movement if he left, he's still not going to adjust the philosophy. Right? So that's the whole point, is that the absolute truth is the absolute truth. We don't adjust it just because people don't like it. Right? Otherwise, you end up with something else. You know, we're not like, you know, Plato and Aristotle that, you know, how you say, Socrates spoke of the absolute truth. Well, okay, got him killed. But then Plato then played that part down. He kept the philosophy but didn't talk about the absolute truth. And then he only talked about other aspects. And then Aristotle adjusted it even more, didn't even talk about those aspects, just talked about, you know, material life, that's all, material consciousness. So he actually became a, you know, a gross materialist, like that. So, not like that. Judson Hall on West 57th Street. Oh, cost $200 to rent for one night. Rai Rama thought it was time Swamiji tried reaching some of the more sophisticated New Yorkers. And since Justin Hall was near Carnegie Hall and sometimes had interesting concerts and lectures, he thought it would be a good place to start. Swamiji agreed to the idea, and Rai Rama printed an announcement, which he distributed in the Midtown bookstores. On the night of the event, the devotees paraded through the Midtown entertainment areas, beating a bass drum and handing out leaflets. Then they returned to Justin Hall for the program. Only 7 people attended. A bass drum, you know, the bass drum with those big ones like this that you wear on the front when they march. So they walked down the street beating that and handing out leaflets. So. The devotees felt terrible. They had misled Swamiji and spent the equivalent of a month's rent. "We can cancel the program if you like, Swamiji," Rai Rama said. But Prabhupada replied, "No, let us chant and speak." So the devotees took the stage and chanted with Swamiji and danced and then sat beside him as he lectured. His voice echoing through the empty hall. Afterwards, Swamiji called for questions. And a young man, about 15 vacant rows back, asked whether he was correct in understanding that the Swami's philosophy was primarily for reforming destitute young people. "No," Prabhupada replied. "Everyone in this material world is lost and destitute, even the so-called successful person, because everyone has forgotten Krishna." After the program, Swamiji sat in a chair by the exit as the few members of the audience were leaving. A respectable-looking couple introduced themselves, and Swamiji sat up very straight with folded palms and smiled. Brahmananda's mother was present, and Swamiji was very cordial toward her. But in general, the devotees were depressed at the small turnout. "I'm sorry, Swamiji. We invited you here, and almost no one came." Rai Rama apologized. But Prabhupada raised his eyebrows and said, "No one? You did not see Narada? You did not see Lord Brahma? When there is chanting of Hare Krishna, even the demigods come to participate." Yes, another time they were in San Francisco. And Prabhupada started laughing during the kirtan and all that. And then the devotees asked him after, "Why were you laughing?" He said, "Because Narad Muni came to watch the Malechas dancing, because they dance so crazy and all that." So Narad Muni was laughing at how they were dancing. So then Prabhupada was laughing, seeing Narad Muni laughing. Back at the temple, Prabhupada chided Rai Rama. I told you we should have charged money. When something is free, people think it is worthless. But just charge $3 or $5 and people will think, oh, you are offering some very valuable thing. In Bengali, there is a story of a man who went house to house offering free mangoes. And no one would take his mangoes because everyone thought, oh, why is he giving away these mangoes? There must be something wrong with them. So he charged 3 rupees, and then they thought, these look like good mangoes. The price is only 3 rupees. All right. So when people see that something is free, they will think it is worthless. Charge them some money, and they will think it is very nice. Right? It means you charge something that they think it's a bargain, right? But because you're charging, then they think it's valuable. Burton Green was a musician, fond of the Swami and fond of banging on the innards of the piano at the temple during kirtan. Burton Green. We had a real explosive thing to break out of with this capitalistic, materialistic egg sitting on us. So there was so much ferocity in the music to break out of. But spinning out like that, you could have a nervous breakdown. So it was great to go to the Swami's and chant in his small storefront on 2nd Avenue. The streets were full of Maya and perversion, and his was a place to really mellow out. It was great to chant there, to balance my life. It was great to sit and have prasadam with the Swami, and get some real authentic Indian cooking, and chapatis, and talk about things, especially when I had very little money in my pocket. It was always nice to go. When Burton asked Prabhupada to attend his piano recital at Town Hall Theater, Prabhupada agreed. Ramananda. About 7 or 8 of us in our sneakers and jeans had ridden on the subway with Swamiji to Town Hall. We went in and took our seats, and the concert began. Burton Green came out, opened the piano top, took a hammer, and began wildly hitting on the strings inside the piano. And it went on for 1.5 hours. We were all sitting there with Swamiji, and we all began chanting on our beads. There were only about 24 people in the whole theater. Then the intermission came, and Swamiji wanted to go to the toilet room. And I went along and helped him, turning on the water in the sink, getting a paper towel for him. Doing these little services for Swamiji seemed like the perfection of my life. There was something so great about him that just doing these things was my perfection. And I felt like I was protecting him, like I was his personal bodyguard. Coming up on the subway, I had shown him how the subway worked and answered his questions. It all seemed very intimate. Anyway, we went back upstairs to our seat, and Burton Green came right up to Swamiji saying, Swamiji, are you happy? Are you comfortable? Do you like it? And Swamiji was very polite and said, yes. Then Burton said, now the second part is coming. I interrupted and tried to say that Swamiji is very tired and he takes a rest at 10. It was already after 10. And so I said we had to go back. But he pressed Swamiji to stay for the second half. And so he had to stay. Then the poets came out and recited poetry. We were there until 11:30, and then we had to ride back on the subway. But a few weeks later, I learned that Prabhupada had another reason for going to Town Hall. He was thinking of renting it for a temple, and he wanted to see it. The Gate Theater was a small auditorium on 2nd Avenue, about 10 blocks north of the storefront, Satsvarup. We rented the Gate Theater for one night. It was a dark place, painted all black. The theater was almost empty. We had an easel on stage with a painting of the Panchatattva. Swamiji spoke, and his talk became very technical. Pointing and referring back to the painting, he described each member of the Panchatattva. He first explained that Lord Chaitanya is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, appearing as a pure devotee. Nityananda, to the right of Lord Chaitanya, is his first expansion. And to the right of Lord Nityananda is Advaita. who is the incarnation of the Supreme Lord. To the left of Lord Chaitanya, he said, is Garadhara, the internal energy, and Srivas is the perfect devotee. During the talk, I was thinking that this was maybe too elevated for the audience, but I was sitting close beside Swamiji, and like the other devotees, I was really enjoying being with him. After the gate engagement, Swamiji and his disciples agreed that it was a waste of time trying to rent theaters. It was better to go to Tompkins Square Park. That was the best place for attracting people, and it didn't cost anything. It was 11 p.m., and only one light was on in Swamiji's apartment, in the kitchenette. Swamiji was staying up, teaching Kirtanananda and Brahmananda how to cook, because the next day, Sunday, they would be holding a feast for the public. Kirtanananda had suggested it be advertised as a love feast, and Swamiji had adopted this name, although some thought it sounded strange at first to hear him say, love feast. The devotees had put up posters around the neighborhood and had made a sign for the window of the storefront. And Swamiji had said he would cook enough for at least 50 people. He said the love feast should become an important part of ISKCON. As he had explained many times, food offered to Krishna becomes spiritual, and whoever eats the prasadam receives great spiritual benefit. Prasadam meant mercy. His two helpers stood respectfully beside him, sometimes stepping back out of his way as he moved and sometimes looking over his shoulder as he mixed spices or set a pan over the flame or called for another ingredient. He was stirring a big pot of sweet rice with a wooden spoon. It had to be stirred constantly and slowly added milk. If the sweet rice burned, it would be ruined, he said, and he handed the spoon to Kirtanananda. He next showed him how to make ghee by heating butter in a wok and separating the milk solids from the butter fat. And he simultaneously taught them how to make apple chutney. Prabhupada was silent as he cooked. But when Brahmananda asked him how he had learned so much about cooking, Prabhupada said he had learned by watching his mother. He laughed and said it had not been and said it had not been like it is in the West, where you take a lump of flesh from your refrigerator, throw it in a pan, boil it, sprinkle it with salt, and then eat it like an animal. And in Korea, he said, they eat dogs. But human beings should eat grains, fruit, vegetables, and milk, and the cow especially should not be killed. While Brahmananda cut the apples for the chutney and put them in a pot for steaming, and Kirtananda stirred the sweet rice, Swamiji prepared masala, the basic mixture of spices, which he would soon add to the steaming apples. The familiar smell of red pepper and cumin seeds entered their nostrils sharply as the masala crackled and smoked in the hot ghee in the tiny frying pan. With three separate operations going at once, sweet rice, steaming apples, and masala, Prabhupada cautioned Kirtananda to stir the sweet rice steadily and scrape the bottom of the pot, and he took the spoon for a moment from Kirtananda's hand and demonstrated how to stir it properly. Sweet rice, chutney, and certain other dishes could be made in advance of the feast, he explained, but many things would have to be done the next morning. Prabhupada rose early, despite having kept late hours the night before. And after the morning class, he was back in the kitchen. Now half a dozen disciples sat in his front room making dough for puris and samosas. He had shown them how to make the dough, and Umapati had kneaded for a while by pounding the soft dough with his fists, but Brahmananda was better at it, socking the weight of his wrestler's body into the large lump of dough. As Swamiji entered the room to examine the quality of the puris, his disciples looked up at him respectfully. They were always serious when he was present. He picked up a puri and examined it. It is not to the standard, he said, but it will have to do. Then, amid crumpled rejects and oddly shaped pieces of dough, He squatted down beside his helpers, who were trying as best they could, though making a mess. He took a small ball of dough, pressed it flat with his fingers, and then deftly rolled it out until it curled around the edge, curled around the wooden pin, and then fell off. A perfect round puri. He held it up, displaying a translucent, thin, but not too thin, patty of dough. "Make them like this," he said, "but hurry." On discovering that the dough was too stiff, Swamiji added a little ghee and then a little milk and kneaded the dough to a softer texture. "Everything should be just right," he said, and his disciples took their menial tasks with concentrated earnestness. Who among them had ever heard of these things before, puris and samosas? It was all new, and the challenge, something very important. It was part of devotional service. Swamiji did much of the cooking as he simultaneously supervised his helpers. He was always near, walking barefoot back to the kitchen, then to the front room, then to his own room in the rear, and then, when he went to his back room, his disciples could see him through the window in the wall. Swamiji saw each of the nearly one dozen dishes through its final stages, and his disciples carried them into the front room in pots, one by one, and placed them before the picture of Lord Chaitanya. There was halva, dal, two sabjis, fancy rice, puris, samosas, sweet rice, apple chutney, and gulab jamuns, or sweet balls, ISKCON bullets. Yeah, it probably says, because this is for the war with Maya, you know, you go out with your ammunition is the gulab jamuns, so if people eat the gulab jamuns, then that will destroy the Maya, right? So, Prabhupada had personally spent much time slowly deep frying the sweet balls on a low heat until they had turned golden brown and full. Then, one by one, he had lifted them out of the ghee with a slotted spoon and put them to soak in sugar syrup. He recognized that these golden ghee-fried milk balls soaked in sugar water were his disciples' favorite prasadam treat. He called them ISKCON bullets because they were weapons in the war against Maya. He even allowed that a jar of ISKCON bullets floating in their syrup be always on hand in the storefront, where his disciples could take them without asking permission and without observing any regulated hours. They could take as many as they liked. That was the keep a pot. I think that's a good idea. You like that idea? I think we would have to keep like a bathtub or something. Yeah, we did that. So you see why we put so much emphasis on cooking? Yeah? That's why everyone's learning to cook, spend so much time cooking. Because then you can do all these things. You're expert because prasadam everybody appreciates. So it's something unique in that. It's actually very hard to find properly cooked food, right? Let alone prasadam, right? So then by here, then it's nicely cooked. It's offered to Krishna. So anybody who takes it, one spirit, they're very attracted. The taste is nice. Then they become Krishna conscious. So it's a very, very important element, right? And everybody likes to eat something nice, right? Anybody here doesn't like nice food? Raise your hand. No? You? You like nice food or bouncing off trees better? Nice food. So how come there's not food on your face? There's only food. Not sure. Okay. Kirtananda brought in the samosa filling, which he had prepared from spinach and green peas cooked to a paste, and which the Swami had heavily spiced. Stuffing the samosas was an art, and Swamiji showed them how to do it. He took a semicircle of dough, shaped it into a cone, stuffed it with a spoon of filling, and then folded the top over and sealed it. A samosa ready for the hot ghee. Achyutananda carried the imperfectly shaped puris into the kitchen, where he and Kirtananda deep-fried them two at a time. If the temperature of the ghee, the consistency of the dough, and the size, shape, and thickness of the puris were all just right, the puris would cook in only a few seconds, rising to the surface of the ghee, where they would inflate like little balloons. The cooks then stood them on edge in a cardboard box to drain off the excess ghee. As they completed the last preparations for the feast, Swamiji's disciples washed the stiff dough from their hands and went down to the storefront, where they set out the straw mats and awaited the guests and the feast. Upstairs, Swamiji had a couple of his cooks offered, and a couple of his cooks offered all the preparations to Lord Chaitanya, reciting the Parampara mantra. The first few love feasts were not very well attended, but the devotees were so enthusiastic about the feast prasadam that they showed no disappointment over the scarcity of guests. The other programs, yes, this, no, okay. So that means, you know, each one of us has to eat 30 gulab jams. Okay, you know, what to do. They were prepared to eat everything. Satsrup. There was something called Brahmana spaghetti, which was rice flour noodles cooked in ghee and soaked in sugar water. And there was halava, pushpana rice with fried cheese. Halava, pushpana rice with fried cheese balls, samosas, split mung peas fried into crunchy pellets, mixed with salt and spices. Wow. That means you take the mung dal and you soak it in water for about 3 hours. So it blows up. Because it has water in it, then you drain it nicely so it's dry. Then you drop it into hot ghee like you would for frying. And because of the water in it, the mung will blow up like a muri, but it won't be soft, it'll be crunchy like this. So that's a... Prabhupada cook all far-out things, right? That all these people can't cook, and he's cooking all these far-out things. Puris, gulab jamuns, and everything was succulent. That was the word Hayagriva used. Yes, he would say, expressing it waggishly, everything was very succulent. Eating the feast was an intense experience. We were supposed to be subduing our senses all week, following strict regulations, controlling the tongue, and the feast was a kind of reward. Swamiji and Krishna were giving us a taste of full spiritual ecstasy, even though we were still beginners and still in the material world. Before taking my plateful, I would pray, please let me remain in Krishna consciousness, because it is so nice and I am so fallen. Let me serve Swamiji, and let me now enjoy this feast in transcendental bliss. And I would begin eating, going from one taste sensation to another. The good rice, the favorite vegetable, the bread, and saving the gulab jamun for last, thinking, I can have seconds, and if I like, thirds. We would keep our eyes on the big pots, confident that there was as much as we wanted. It was a time of rededication. We all enjoyed with completely open relish and sense gratification. Eating was very important. Gradually, attendance picked up. The feasts were free, and they were reputed to be delicious. Mostly local hippies came, but occasionally a higher class of experimenting New Yorkers or even the parents of one of the devotees would come. When the small temple was filled, guests would sit in the courtyard. They would take their prasadam-laden paper plates and their wooden spoons into the backyard garden and sit beneath the fire escape or at the picnic table or anywhere. And after eating, they would go back into the storefront for more. Devotees were stationed behind the pots of prasadam, and the guests would come by for seconds. The other tenants were not very happy about seeing the courtyard full of festive guests. And the devotees tried to pacify them by bringing them plates of prasadam. Although Swamiji would not go down to the temple, he would take a plate in his room and hear with pleasure about the success of the new program. One time the devotees were eating so ravenously that they threatened to eat everything available before the guests had all been served. and Kirtananda had to admonish them for their selfish attitude. Gradually, they were understanding that the Sunday feast was not just for their fun and pleasure, but to bring people to Krishna consciousness.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.